Okay, well, my starting point is there's quite a bit of sepia-tinted nostalgia about the very earliest days of radio. And, of course, lots of familiar images about that earlier period. And here are just one set of images, which are the kind of the images of transmitter masts, sort of enormous, crackling with energy. And you have the iconic ones, the Eiffel Tower and Zhukov's Tower and Tesla's sort of uncompleted tower in Long Island. And then you also have more workaday transmitter masts, one at Poldhu and one at Cape Cod and so on, not quite so iconic, but basically kind of big and powerful, one of the images of radio. And I suppose the standard contrasting image of early radio is at the domestic end, which is odd-looking, but small and benign and comforting. Now, I want to linger today, really, on, before these sort of images had become polarised, a sort of darker side to the earlier images of radio. And I want to organise them into four overlapping sets of images, which for sort of rhetorical purposes I kind of call four different kinds of air war. The first one, I suppose, is to go back to that image of power and magnitude, which we can associate with radio. And you see it in popular wireless magazines, in adverts and posters and so on. It's the iconography of radio as something dominating. And part of this is because radio's most vocal publicist, Marconi, was obsessed with conquering distance. To cross whole oceans wirelessly, which was his main objective, he was convinced he needed to generate huge electrical currents and then transmit them from as high a point above land as possible. So scale and immensity mattered, and that was the early one in Poldhu. That was just a tiddler compared with one that he built a few years later at Carnarvon, the Great Transatlantic Station, as he called it, which sent signals directly to New Jersey. It had a 10,000-volt supply, and the transmitter motors on the ground were spinning at 1,460 revolutions per minute to each generate 1,750 volts. These are the kind of bits of information that were publicised widely to create the impression of power and immensity. And those transmitters sent pulses along an aerial that was 3,600 feet long, 500 feet wide, strung around 10 steel masts, each 400 feet in height. So much power, in fact, that transmitter stations like this very frequently burst into flames and were sometimes burnt to the ground and had to be rebuilt. Well, conquest was a recurrent theme in this imagery. And if you look at the cover of the very first edition of Wireless World, which was a Marconi company publication, you can see here a sort of later version of the Poldhu transmitter up in that corner, bathed in darkness, and on the other side of the world, bathed in sunshine, a ship somewhere off the coast of Australia. And this kind of white pulsating streak of Morse code connecting them, travelling whatever it is, 12,500 miles. In fact, that was impossible at this stage. I mean, the radio signal couldn't carry that far. It spells out Marconi. So, yes, he was... the Wireless World was really a kind of marvellous work of self-publicity. Inside Wireless World, inside this very first issue, there's an article about the London skyline, and it compares what it calls the two main features of the London skyline. First of all, the neo-Gothic spires of the Houses of Parliament, the lawgiver, and then the aerial masts of Marconi House, a new power in the world, it says, power over the elements and forces of nature, annihilating space, building colonial ties. The regular features inside Wireless World were lots of stories about wireless operatives toiling away in various godforsaken outposts of empire. Marconi men were frontiersmen. They were bringing civilization to an uncivilized world. You had operators on merchant ships as well, who were constantly celebrated for their bravery. And during the war, there was a constant series of stories profiling those who'd been killed, 10 or 11 killed in action every month. And shipping disasters were the magazine was filled with stories of shipping disasters. This is the Volturno, which was sailing across the Atlantic in October 1913. It had 657 emigrants from Eastern Europe heading towards the States, and it burst into fire in amid a storm. And the Marconi operator sent out a signal, and 10 ships came to rescue, but not before about 100 people had thrown themselves into the water. So here was a case of wireless saving lives, just as it had supposedly with the Titanic, but also a story about how people had not put sufficient faith in wireless. If only they'd realised how wireless was going to save their lives, they wouldn't have thrown themselves into the water to start off with. So Wireless World sort of stokes anxiety by contrasting the power of radio with the powerlessness of those who didn't have it. It talks about the fear of being isolated, cut off from help in a world full of danger. And all this amplified the idea of radio as a kind of weapon as well. It was part of the arms race. It was a branch of national service, something which might protect or enhance a country's supremacy in the world. An editorial of Wireless World in 1917 said that wireless was about seizing dominion in the ether. And I suppose what comes to mind sometimes is that some of the ideas of someone like Marinetti, who was interested in wireless, and he thought of radio as like a machine gun able to spray messages like bullets. And you get a kind of a faint whiff of this sort of aesthetic in more everyday iconography of transmitter masts and the power of radio. And in poems like this that was published in the New York Sun in 1913, which said, "Man has stolen the wings of the deathless things. Unseen, unheard, leaps the wraith of a word, like a god on a godlike quest." Well, so that's one sense of an air war, something to do with power. A second one is the sort of sinister aspects that I think it's worth contemplating at the receiving end of the apparatus. And what one saw when you looked at an early bit of radio was something that was complicated and, in truth, a little bit weird. To catch wireless signals, there was a lot of ad hoc lashing together of various objects so that the back garden sheds and parlours where people set up their radio kits really looked more like laboratories than sort of relaxing domestic environments. They were kind of mysterious, they were manly, they were places of endless electrical tinkering. Receiving kits were also, by and large, capable of being transmitter kits. So early wireless listeners were also broadcasters. And by 1914, the air was thick, really, with Morse code signals moving in all directions. Now, this has been referred to and kind of viewed, I think, as an exciting period of freedom and experimentation. But I think what you look at, what you see when you look back at this, is actually something which is quite exclusive, quite secretive in this early radio culture. And if you look at some of the transactions of a lot of the early wireless clubs, it's very clear that they're very controlling. They're not for everyone. There's a clear distinction between the so-called irresponsible amateurs and the genuine experimenters. And in fact, these clubs were encouraged by Wireless World precisely to impose some sense of order and hierarchy on the world of amateur listening, to suppress, I quote, "the nuisance of casual amateur knob twiddlers," people who just wanted to listen. So this second kind of air war was a hidden war on an intimate scale, and the word code was a central part of it. Now, obviously, it was part of it because until you had voice transmissions, what we're dealing with is the transmission of signals in Morse. And in wartime, of course, there had to be further scrambling of the message, so you had a code wrapped in a code. But its association with secrecy went much deeper than this. It was the very invisibility of radio which created a nagging sense of mystery about it. So magazines were full of ghost stories, for instance. But they were also full of strange real-life phenomena that were reported. So in 1913, for instance, Wireless World tells us about a man who had lashed together piano wires, cake tins, and an old metal bedstead in order to listen to radio from Paris. And we hear later about, in Sweden, a singing coal shovel. We hear about, in Ohio, a tin roof that appeared to make political speeches and occasionally burst into song. So this was very unsettling, but it was also very intoxicating. It was full of dramatic potential. The invisible, coded, fugitive, furtive nature of wireless made it the perfect vehicle for dramatising a new world of espionage, especially in those years just running up to the First World War and during the war, when enemy attempts at invasion were suspected at every turn. Now, we know that invasion stories had been a staple of the press and literature for years, and William Le Queux, I suppose, provided the archetype. But Wireless World was one of several wireless magazines that provided an unending stream of overheated stories which revolved around wireless. I mean, let's just pick one out and describe it very briefly. And that's a serialized story called A Pawn in the Game that was published in Wireless World between 1913 and 1914. It featured Charles Summers, the son of a local vicar in a Sussex village, who was developing in his garden workshop a strange machine, which turns out to be a Marconi wireless-controlled airship equipped with some sort of flamethrower device. Now, being a good patriot, he wants to pass the blueprints of this machine to the War Office. Inevitably, the War Office dithers, failing to recognise the urgent need to buy up the Marconi equipment in vast numbers straight away. And two strangers then turn up in the village, the dark and swarthy Monsieur Dupont and the fair and well-made Herr Bwilner. Their appearance is a little alien in this Sussex village. Monsieur Dupont is described thus: a stoop, a straggly beard, thick gold-rimmed glasses, a shabby coat, worn and ill-fitting gloves, a battered walking stick. He was, we are told, looking the part of a seedy university professor to perfection. Well, anyway, this pair trick their way into getting plans for the experimental airship and promptly flee abroad. But all is not lost, because just in time, Charles Summers succeeds in building a full-size version of his invention and repels the inevitable German air invasion. Well, the interest in this is that this is the kind of story which is set against the background of all the other stuff which is being published in Wireless World. The news reports about foreign spies lurking in attics, sending messages back home via hidden homemade transmitters. So, for example, in September 1914, there's a detailed report about several agents of the German Secret Service who'd been discovered sending messages to German boats in the North Sea. And German U-boats, it was noted during the war, seemed to have extraordinarily good information about the position of ships, and this was put down to a network of German spies believed to be equipped with radios throughout Britain. Now, some of this was real, so that you do get examples. I mean, this is actually from New York. In June 1917, the capture of one improbably named, but apparently quite real, German spy called Max Wax, with a cunningly disguised transmitter packed in a suitcase. This was the sort of sine qua non of espionage now, a suitcase wireless transmitter. Of course, much of this was also exaggerated rumour and falsehood. But it was useful to the Marconi Company because it encouraged anxiety over Britain's preparedness for war. Wireless World also saw this sort of network of spies as manifesting a sort of general weakness, this unpreparedness, a weakness in the body politic. And just to return briefly to A Pawn in the Game, one of the characters was Charles Summers' fiancée, Gwen. And of course, the spies only got hold of the plans for a wireless airship in the first place because of the naivety of Gwen. She was waylaid, we are told, by Fabianism. and pacifism. The point is that if you read The Wireless World, what we get is the impression that Gwen was not alone. Lots of minds were thought to be dangerously impressionable, which brings me to the third kind of air war, the infectious nature of information in the airwaves themselves. The ether is the controlling metaphor here. Now, the ether is something which has been disproved scientifically, but it survived as a useful rhetorical device in wireless circles, and it represented a kind of universal connecting medium. The concept of a universal connecting medium, in turn, contributed to the idea of messages, ideas, being able to spread like a contagion. So Wireless World reported German wireless stations radiating, as it put it, vast floods of false news, reports moving through the ether like a virus. These lies, it was said, were like a poison gas. And in the face of such propaganda, Wireless World suggested that Britain too should immediately invent a device to filter out untruths and saturate the ether instead with what it called truth ions. In a literal sense, it was encouraging the idea of counter-propaganda. And by invoking the ether as a new and effective means of spreading partisan messages, the idea was also unleashed of the ether as an inherently public space through which radio waves could just as easily circulate knowledge and sweet reason. Now, one of the key figures in this is Oliver Lodge, the Victorian scientist, who saw in the ether a kind of transcendence. It was a medium through which thought itself could escape the mundane limits of the human brain and then travel through a sea of mental energy and imprint itself on other people's brains. The ether also bound together and made coherent what would otherwise for him be a chaos of individual elements. As a Fabian and a social reformer, Lodge believed that the idea of an all-embracing ether nurtured a belief in the underlying unity of human existence. Well, let's just fast forward a little. And in November 1920, we come across the League of Nations First Assembly, and a small ad hoc wireless station was set up in Geneva, and the person running it was someone called Arthur Burroughs, who had once worked for Marconi, but now saw radio as a tool for disarmament. And if minds could be controlled, then it was a means of controlling them for the better. To alter for the better the social life of the people and international relations, he said. Above all, it was to spread throughout the world a doctrine of common sense. And against this backdrop, the image changes. So we have the broadcaster, the first issue in August 1922, a very different tone to the somewhat authoritarian and bossy Wireless World. The cover, a simple domestic scene of listening. Inside, we have articles speculating about what would happen in the next few years. There would be ballroom dancing from wireless music concerts on transatlantic planes. Courting couples would listen to the wireless on boats. Miniature radio sets would be possible one day soon. Terms such as listener in or wireless amateur were now regarded as inadequate. Instead, the broadcaster suggested etherites. It was a word for all equally who made use of the same invisible wonder, ether. Well, now the ether didn't exist, but even its more workaday analogue, simple air, was saturated with meaning. And that brings me to my fourth and last set of images. A connection that I think exists between the world of early flying, the novel sensation of being up in the air, and the birth of broadcasting. An extraordinary number of the BBC pioneers of the early 1920s had been pilots and aerial observers during the First World War. One of them here is Cecil Lewis, who later went on to publish Sagittarius Rising in 1936, a classic, colourful account of the Royal Flying Corps' aerial wartime exploits. He writes about the excitement of many hours spent, as he put it, 2 miles above the earth in the vast rotunda of the evening sky, moving like a spirit in exalted eminence. His aerial view, he said, instilled in him a sense of the futility of war, and for him, broadcasting became a job of peacemaking. Another slightly less well-known figure is Lance Sieverking, a pioneering modernist feature and drama producer and wartime pilot. In June 1922, in the English Review, he wrote an essay called The Psychology of Flying. Being in the air, he said, induced a new mental attitude. It fostered a special kind of objectivity, a desire to see the big picture, and it also speeded up the brain. It gave one a faster, clearer sense of meaning. Wartime, though, he said, had scarred him, because whenever he was now on the ground, he had the infinitely distressing sensation of being clamped down, manacled by the very grass blades. For Sieverking, then, broadcasting represented a chance to be unmanacled again. The BBC was, he said once, another air force. And in September 1928, he directed his first big production called Kaleidoscope. And here you see a picture that he drew of himself. At the controls, the dramatic control panel, looking very much like a cockpit, in fact, partly designed to recreate the feel of a cockpit. And he described producing and directing that programme live on air in September 1928. He said, "The same thrill was now coursing through him. I felt exactly as I felt on that cold, bright morning when I had been told to take the aeroplane into the air alone for the first time." Communication and flying both use the air as their medium, cutting through it with speed and accuracy. So getting work at the BBC felt to Sieverking like a homecoming. So to finish, I think by 1922, all those earlier air wars, dominated by images first of power, later of secrecy, had given way to something more elevated. Wireless World had wallowed in the mysterious and furtive properties in order to fuel anxiety and, frankly, to profit by it. But radio's images were too rich in meaning to be so narrowly pinned down. Its pervasiveness allowed it to move from representing private acts of intelligence to fostering something new, a kind of public intelligence. And I think we can think of it as a form of mind control coming out from the shadows and shedding its darker past.